Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is family love and acceptance enough to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender teens from the sometimes harsh judgments of their peers? It came as no surprise to my guest today that his youngest son, Joseph, was gay. John Schwartz and his wife, Jean, had had inklings from the time Joseph was in preschool, and when he came out to them at the age of 13, they made it clear that their affection for him was entirely unchanged. So you can imagine their shock very soon after when they discovered Joe had tried to take his own life with an overdose of medication and realized his journey toward self-esteem might be a longer one than they had expected. John Schwartz is a national correspondent for The New York Times. His new memoir is called Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. John, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you.
We will set everybody's mind at ease by saying that Joseph today is very much alive and well.
That's right. Spoiler alert.
It's a reasonable one, and I'm glad to know it. It did strike me as a scary wake-up call for parents who might assume that because they are accepting of their kids' sexual orientation, they can somehow help their kids navigate adolescence without too much trauma. Is that how you and your wife had felt?
Well, we felt that we were being supportive. We felt that Joseph understood our values and would never hold anything against him. But, you know, however supportive we might be, you're not his whole world,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know what other pressures he's living with. And even more important, you don't know what the pressures are internally. I mean, you can have conversations, but you might miss signals, and that's what we were doing.
You're adamant at the start of this book that not only did you not set out to write a self-help book, that you're in fact suspicious of most self-help books. What did you hope to accomplish by writing this story?
Well, a memoir is a great thing in that it shows people what you did. And if the story is told in a way that resonates with you, you might decide, oh my God, I'd never do what they did. They're
mm-hmm.
insane. Right? But in the process of reading the book, you've thought about how you would respond to it. This doesn't tell you how to do what we did. The idea is to get parents to think about how they would do it.
Hmm.
Because what am I an expert in? Nothing. I'm a newspaper reporter.
What sort of conversations did you have with Joseph about your plans to write the book? And did you want to wait until you felt like he was out of the woods in terms of his own mental health before you went ahead with this?
Well, that's exactly right. The first thing was to make sure that we felt comfortable, that Joe was on a good track, and that he didn't seem to be in trouble. And we got there, and then I sat him down. We were driving, and I said, I'm thinking about writing a book that would talk about our experiences, and I'm not going to even propose it if you're against it, but I want to know what you think. And Joe said, well, I think you should do it. And I said, well, you know, that's a little too fast, thanks. But because our kids, you know, I am a newspaper reporter, and I've written about the kids many times, and they've sort of gotten used to being written about. I said, you know, Joe, this is different. This is book length. There are parts of it that are going to be embarrassing. I'm going to talk about the hospital. I'm going to talk about the pills. And he said, do it.
Hmm.
He wasn't being dismissive. It was, you know, why are you asking me the same question twice when I gave it thought? And he's like that. He's a very thoughtful guy, certainly smarter than me on so many levels. And so still, we walked him through it. When the manuscript was done, I sat down with him that day, and he read through the whole thing. He went upstairs, thought about it, came down actually a couple of days later and said, here are things I want to change. Here are things I don't think you've got right. This is what I object to. And we talked out each of those and improved the book that way.
Hmm.
So Joe's not just given his approval, he's been part of the process. And then the last chapter of the book is a children's book that Joe wrote as a class assignment that we all loved and which many people who read the book think is better written than the book itself.
It really is a wonderful sort of appendix, I should say, to the rest of the story.
Well, thank you. I feel that he said in 800 words, I was trying to say in 60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you want your kids to do, right? It surpass you? Isn't that the point?
Before you had kids, you and Jean, your wife, decided that you would try really hard to avoid gender stereotyping of toys and games and just of what it meant to be a woman or a man. Talk a little bit about how that played out with each of your kids.
Well, it was very simple. It's not like we used Free to Be You and Me as a playbook or anything, but we thought, oh, you don't want to presuppose anything. And so the toys we bought were neutral. We had Barbies and trucks and all the other things. And our daughter Elizabeth was born in 1987, and she loved the Barbies and played with the Barbies. And 3 years later, her little brother Sam came along, and as soon as Sam could crawl, he went over to that stack of toys, and he could not throw the Barbies far enough away from the pile on the way to get the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the truck boy, and he's got a lot of yang. You know, he's a very masculine boy. He ended up being a varsity football player, wrestler. I mean, a lot of yang in that boy. Joseph came along, same stack, roughly the same toys, though many were damaged by Sam. But Joe pulled out the Barbies. And Joe didn't just want to play with them as action figures. He was dressing them. And so my wife, who spent hours playing with them on the floor and dressing Barbie, said, Barbie never looked so fabulous. And she thought, well, you know, this is interesting. This is something, this might be a clue to how Joe's going to turn out. We'll have to see.
Was that a fraught moment the first time you discussed it with each other? I'm guessing that you each had a sense that maybe this was in his future and didn't want to say anything, or was it just kind of something that came up in general conversation?
It came up in general conversation. It was not something that we were worried about or upset about. It was in the same way that you might say, this one I think is going to turn out left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be tall, isn't he? It's you know, who is he going to be? And I have to say, it wasn't anything that we felt powerfully about as an attribute. When so many of our friends growing up were gay, so many of our friends at the University of Texas, where we were in the 1970s, were gay, it just seemed like something that's basically baked into you.
You were totally okay with this. However, you did sort of tuck away the Barbie collection before he went off to kindergarten. This is something that I know that you've given a lot of thought to at the time and even since then. Can you talk about that decision?
Well, sure. This was Jean's decision. About the time he was getting ready to go off to kindergarten, she put the Barbies away because she was afraid that he would go to school and take a Barbie for show and tell. And would talk about this particular costume coordination or something like that. And that he'd be ridiculed for it. And that the kids, who can be cruel at any age, would be pretty tough on him. And so she thought in the moment that she did it that this would maybe spare Joseph some trouble. And in the years since, first of all, we realized that it was not the best way to go, that it was a well-intended mistake. Joe was different in so many ways that
Barbie's that notwithstanding, yeah.
Barbie's notwithstanding, it was going to come out anyway. It did come out. And so, in fact, all we were doing was denying who he was. And Jean feels awful about it. And as we say in the book, we were the ones who built his first closet by putting the Barbies away. But it's not something we would recommend that people do.
Early in his school career, I think it's really fascinating when you sort of go through each of his early years in school, and it seems like we should pause for a moment and say he had some other behavioral and educational issues despite being incredibly bright. And the teachers who sort of got him, he really thrived with, and the teachers who didn't, it was sort of a disaster.
Well, you're exactly right. And teachers who were flexible, he did great with. Teachers who were supportive. Teachers who had a kind of my way or the highway attitude, I'm going to teach one way for all 25 kids, things tended to go badly, and sometimes extremely badly. Now, that it's also, you know, we were watching Joe's behavior. He could get kind of mulish. He would drift off and not do work. There were other things going on, and in the years with bad teachers, those behaviors got much, much worse.
I think if there's a, aside from Joe's suicide attempt, if there's a heartbreaking moment in the book for me, it's when you had seen a series of therapists just to sort of see if you could help him with his academic issues. And you and Jean brought up to one of the early ones that you saw, hey, could any of these social issues be related to him sort of struggling to find his identity as someone who might be gay? And she said to you, what a horrible thing to say about your child.
And we were dumbfounded. Our jaws dropped. And we were too startled really to say, what in the world do you mean? Because it's very possible what she was saying was you're prejudging, you're presupposing, which wasn't what we were doing. We just thought this was an inkling that was growing over time, a sense that we had. But we never did go back and say, what did you mean about that? What it did do was made us think, you know, maybe people don't want to hear this. Maybe they don't want to talk about it.
And that wasn't the only adult who sort of brushed aside this what was clearly to you at least an element of his development.
Well, that's right, Chris. We felt that many of the problems that Joe was having were either caused or made worse by the fact that he felt somewhat isolated in the school. He, by elementary school, little boys, a lot of little boys in our elementary school anyway, knew the entire starting lineup of the Giants. They had very strong theories about sports. Now, there are a lot of gay kids who grew up who love sports and are obsessed with them and are great players of sports themselves. That wasn't Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joe was this kid who really just wanted to be with the girls, really loved talking to them. That's something that worked pretty well in, say, kindergarten. But as time goes on, the girls start to differentiate, the boys start to differentiate. And while the boys are becoming more sports-obsessed, the girls are starting to realize that boys are kind of yucky.
Right, so suddenly he had cooties along with the rest of the boys, but he didn't fit in with them.
Yeah. Right, so he's not fitting in with anybody, and that's when a sense of social isolation really sets in.
At what point, having spoken to him subsequently, did Joseph himself start to realize that he was gay and what that might even have meant?
Well, as we were putting the book together, we asked, and Joseph, who reaches back into his memory with varied success on this one, knew exactly what it was. He said he was about 8 years old, and he was online, and he came across the concept of homosexuality, and he thought, well, I should look into this. And he discovered, to his surprise, he said, that it's normal for boys to like girls. And he was stunned by this. He was really sort of, ooh, really? And so he then realized at the age of 8 that, well, okay, that must mean that I'm the other thing. And then he didn't worry about it. He didn't worry about it at the time because it wasn't, at that early age, sexuality. It wasn't sexual desire. It was just sexual orientation. I mean, even if he didn't know what he'd be doing or what it all meant, he only knew in a rough way what team he was on, not what he was, you know, it wasn't a sexual moment. In other
right.
words. I don't know if I'm making this clear.
Yeah, yeah.
He just knew what his orientation was. And only a few years after that did it become an issue as boys started talking about girls, and he started to feel that he really had a kind of a secret, a dark secret that he couldn't talk about.
John Schwartz is my guest. He's national correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. We will open it up to calls now. If you'd like to join us, you can phone 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Schwartz, who is a national correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. John, how aware were you at the time that you and your wife first had inklings that Joseph might be gay of the dramatically higher suicide and attempted suicide rates for LGBT teenagers?
Well, Chris, at the time, it wasn't that much in the news. This is more than 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was well before Tyler Clementi. It was well before the Anoka Hennepin School District lawsuits. It was something that you knew that some gay kids were troubled, but the idea that it was coalescing into a statistically higher rate of suicide and, as they say, suicidal ideation, thinking about suicide, wishing for it, it was not something that we had come across. And so the more we learned, the worse it sounded, the more problems these kids appeared to have, and not just from bullying. You know, there's a standard storyline today of gay teen plus bullying equals suicide. But in fact, a lot of kids who are troubled by their sexual orientation might not be rejected by their families, might not be bullied by their schoolmates. They might just have taken in these bad attitudes about gay people that they see on the media, that they hear from their friends when they say things like, oh, that's so gay. They pick it up because it's in the air around them, and they internalize it and develop a kind of inner bully, mm-hmm. who is or can be worse on them, harder on them than anybody in the cafeteria. And you have to add to that, if they're concealing their orientation, you add to that the absolute strain of keeping the secret. And you've got a bad recipe.
And you take pains to point out here that Joseph experienced some of these problems, including social isolation, despite the fact that he was, as you describe it, not in a tough school district. It was upper middle class kids, you know, of educated parents. One would assume, all things being equal, he'd be better off there than in a place that was different.
That's right. And in a pretty good time to be a gay kid, mm-hmm. right? We've got gay people in prominent roles on television. We've got Ellen DeGeneres. You've got, in more recent years, shows like Glee and Modern Family. The images are there. The people are out. In so many ways, it's a very good time. But there are still plenty of negative messages as well, and kids hear those.
So, of course, young people do not enjoy talking with their parents about sexuality, typically. How did you sort of set the stage to make conversations possible with Joseph, recognizing completely that it was his right to come out to you rather than you sort of probing him for this information?
Well, Gene and I have a lot of gay friends today, and we were trying to figure out what to do with this kid who, increasingly, we realized was gay. Increasingly, we realized was troubled about it, or troubled about keeping this secret concealed. And so we talked to these buddies, the folks that Gene and I call the League of Gay Uncles. And I said to each of these guys, what would you have wanted your parents to do? Ideally, what would your parents have done? Would you have had them push you into the light? Would you have said, or confront you and say, look, I know you're gay, and let's talk about it? And they said, oh, God, no. Please, not.
Yeah. So you also knew that you couldn't say, well, we've known all along. John, are you with us? Okay, I think we have lost our connection with John Schwartz. We will get him back on the line in just a moment. My guest this hour is John Schwartz. We will come back to the conversation in a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Schwartz about his new memoir, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. John, I'm glad we've got you back on the line.
Sorry about that, Chris.
Oh, it's okay. Phones do this all the time. You were starting to tell us about consulting your friends that you jokingly called the League of Gay Uncles and saying what would have been ideal for you growing up. And one thing they told you is they didn't want their parents to sort of drag them out into the light. They wanted to come out themselves.
Right, because they said, if this is a secret, it's his secret. If this is his thing to reveal, then he should reveal it in his own way, on his own clock. And they suggested very strongly that he would, but that we could help. We could help pave the way. And that was what we hadn't thought about, because, as you were saying, a teenage kid doesn't want to talk to his parents about anything. And sexuality had become a very tough issue. We could talk about gay topics or sexual topics around the table, and if something came up, Joseph would get up from the table, go up to his room, and slam the door. He just didn't want to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And these friends said, that's exactly the point. You need to say more, not less. Don't be polite and avoid the topic. Make sure he understands where you stand. And so they suggested, especially my friend Brian, suggested that we work gay issues into our conversation. If a political candidate was talking about it, if there were news stories that dealt with gay issues, just bring them up. It might seem a little forced at first, and boy, did it ever. But over time, Joseph stopped getting up from the table and slamming the door, and then he left the door open. And then he came down and joined in the conversation. And so we were able to say, in a way that we hadn't before, even though we thought we were being supportive and expressing it in a quiet way, we were saying explicitly, whoever you are, it's all right. We're fine.
You don't draw the line directly from one to the other in the book, but you write about the fact that unlike your other two kids, Joseph was not really interested in making his bar mitzvah. But then when he finally came out to you, it struck me as sort of a parallel moment. And I don't know how you feel about that conclusion that I drew.
Well, it's just Joe becoming himself. He was, you know, his brother and his sister were both willing to go along and get the bar mitzvah for Elizabeth. The bat mitzvah was about having a moment in the sun and being able to show that she had mastered this material. And for Sam, it was about having a party and having his friends, you know, to the party. And this is the stuff I'm willing to do to have the party.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came time for Joe, he didn't want to do it. He was withdrawing from religion in general. And it was all starting to come at a time when he was having a terrible time in school. And Gene and I both felt that this was one more source of stress in his life. And so, you know, I said, look, you can show your friends you're smart, like Elizabeth did. And he said, they don't even know I'm smart. I don't care. And I said, well, you know, Sammy, the party. And he said, I don't like parties. but really, it was not that, but this increasing stress in his life and the fact that we were trying to pare away at the things that were causing him trouble, causing him pressure at the time. And we went to our rabbi at the time, who was gay and really supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, if he's having this much trouble right now, this is one more thing that he doesn't need to deal with, but the door is open if he wants to come back. And that's where we left it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Tex in Eustis. Hi, Tex.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
What I just wanted to say very quickly was, as a public school teacher of 40-plus years, I am so impressed with this young man's parents, and he is blessed to have his parents, because so many of the students that I see every day in agony at school being made fun of are not only being teased and harassed by their peers, but unfortunately some of their teachers, and most of it comes from religious backgrounds, because so many of the churches and religions and denominations preach from the pulpit that if you're gay, you're going to hell, God doesn't love you, you're an abomination. And kids hear that, their parents hear that, they teach their kids. And so as staunchly as you may support your children at home, they get a steady diet of that at school.
Do you want to respond to that, John?
Well, it's one of the sources of pressure, and it's an awful thing to tell a kid that he's bad because of who he is. And I just hope that as the growing understanding, and if you read the Gallup polls, you see greater acceptance of gay people and less attention on, or less belief in the idea that this is a lifestyle, more of a belief and a growing understanding that this is some component of biology, some component of really, you know, as I said, baked in who you are. And religious people who become okay with that generally say things like, that's the way God made him. When a close relative comes out and you still love that person, you know, whatever the preacher is saying, if you believe that this is biology and not a choice, a lifestyle, then what are you going to do about that person you love? And I think I have a lot of faith myself in the phrase, that's the way God made him, as a path to more acceptance for people.
So you knew John, obviously, Joseph had come out to you and your wife and had received acceptance at home. Did you know that he was also sort of making strides at school to be more open about this?
Well, Joe would tell me about it. As this was all in 2009, as he came out to us at the end of the year. And in our conversation in which he came out to me, he said that he was dropping hints at school. He didn't say he was dropping hints. He said he was trying to sort of freak the other kids out a little bit and say things to them like, do you think Bill knows just how attractive he is? And he said that the other kids would sometimes say to him things like, well, Joseph, are you saying you're gay? Are you telling me you're gay? And so what would you tell him? And Joe said, oh, I just smile. I leave them wondering.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was starting to drop these hints to them, and this was all over dinner. Joe and I had gone out together for dinner, and I said, well, Joe, are you telling me you're gay? Because, you know, I'm not your friend. I'm actually hearing what you're saying. And he said, well, I might be. And we ate a little more. We, you know, the dessert comes, the little orange slices, and I said, this thing that you haven't told me, would it be all right if I told Mom? He said, yeah. And that was it. He was out, at least to us. And over time, over those next few weeks, he was more forceful in coming out with the other kids as well.
What kind of response did he get at school?
Well, unfortunately, when he really did decide to just openly say it, it was in a sort of open, it was a sort of explosive way. It was in almost a tantrum. He was confronting the boys about their own attitudes, and he was saying, you know, and you rate girls. You rate girls all the time. And I'm going to rate you. You're a 5. You're a 7.
Let me jump in. You're saying rate. I just want to make sure that people understand over the phone. T-E.
T like Tom. Yes,
yes.
I'm sorry. Right. You give girls ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to rate you. And the boys were unsettled by this. They went to a school administrator and complained essentially that Joe had harassed them, that Joe had bullied them. And for whatever reason, that was the day that Joe came home and took all the pills.
I mean, I just, you know, I have 2 13-year-olds myself, and the thought of discovering your child gravely ill from this is just devastating. Do you, I mean, talk a little bit about the healing process and the psychiatric care that you sought for Joseph and how all of this sort of came together as he was growing beyond this moment where he felt so hopeless?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because that's really what the book is about. It's really what the book is for. We didn't just want to tell a sad story. Things have gotten tremendously better, and it's largely because of the treatment he's gotten, but also the organizations and services we found. And so not only did he get help from therapists, he'd gotten help off and on from therapists throughout his childhood, but what really happened when he came out was we were able to take advantage of the services offered through the Gay Center in New York City. The Gay Center has a youth program. It's on 13th Street. It's this wonderful, decades-old community center that is actually in an old school, and their youth programs include a weekly community discussion where kids can get together and talk about what they're going through. There's a moderator who's often got social work training, and they even have a summer camp, 1 week summer camp, where these kids spend much of the summer preparing to go away, and it is it's everything you would want in a summer camp, the hikes and the s'mores, but there's also this therapeutic component because lots of these kids have problems. The community has problems, and the center is there for the kids to help them develop in a balanced way. And so this was perfect for Joe because not only did he get some of the therapeutic value of these services, he also got a community. And he was able to see he wasn't alone. He wasn't so far out there. And so between programs like that and just being able to join a Gay Straight Alliance in the high school and see that there were other kids around him in his little suburban town, things opened up in a tremendous way. He calmed down in a tremendous way. I mean, even going to theater camp was a way to say, look where you are. Look where you are in the world. You're not so strange. You're not off. And all of that has helped him just calm down, just find his feet under him. And whatever other issues he was dealing with from childhood on, a lot of those pressures, a lot of those behaviors have lessened, have abated over time as he's grown into Joe.
John Schwartz is my guest. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask a question, maybe share a story, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Schwartz, national correspondent for the New York Times and author of Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, obviously the book is about helping Joseph come to terms, as you say in the subtitle, with his sexuality. I'm curious as to whether you thought there needed to be a balance between, you know, seeking out camps and clubs and organizations to sort of make things easier for Joseph as he grew into himself, and not at the same time making too much of this. Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. The fact is, Joseph is not one thing. He's not just gay. And you know, at the same time that we had been seeking out these services, we were keeping him in his piano classes, his voice classes. He was involved in theater. We were trying to give him as well-rounded a development as his brother and sister got. You want them to find their interests and pursue their interests, and that's the job of parenting.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Ralph in Arlington. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. A quick comment and question. Me and my friends use the word gay a lot to describe something we don't like or something that's annoying. It's part of our lexicon. It's part of the language I grew up with. And we don't mean anything wrong by it. The comedian Louis C.K. did a pretty good explanation of it, if you don't mind the language. My question is, it's pretty integrated into how we speak. My little brother says it sometimes. Probably the younger kids are learning to say it. How did you deal with it? Did you just accept it and move on, or did you make a distinction as to, you know, how it's said and how it's used versus what it used to mean or what it means to different people?
Well, in our family, it just wasn't the way we talked. And so it wasn't an issue in our family. Even Joe's older brother, who was one of the jocks, didn't talk that way around the house. And so it didn't come up within our home. What happens on the street and in the playground, you don't have a lot of control over, but we didn't reinforce it. It's just not who we are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Kevin on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I was calling because I wanted to thank him for writing this book and also thank you for the way that you treated your child. When I was growing up, I knew I was gay at 5 years old. I could understand I didn't know to call it that, but I was treated terribly. And I was beaten. I was ridiculed. My mother hurt someone to even try to kill me. And it has affected me my entire life. So thank you so much for what you've done to your child and for writing this book. I really appreciate it. And I wish that I could take my journals from childhood and turn them into a book. But thank you very much.
Kevin, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your story.
I wanted to say something, Chris. The most amazing thing in writing the book, when Gene and I started writing this, we didn't think it was even necessary to go beyond saying that we knew that we would support Joe, we knew we would love him, and he was the same child. Before we knew he was gay as after, before coming out as after, just supporting our child, that seemed like breathing. That was the natural thing. In the time since the book has gotten out there, I've heard from so many men who have said, this was the family I wanted, if only I'd had this support. And it's heartbreaking to know that what seems so obvious to us has not been obvious, has not been a part of people's lives. I just wish other people had what we considered the first step. Just accepting, just loving and embracing, just from the beginning.
Was there anyone in your family or a friend of the family that was troubled by this, that counseled you somehow not to embrace this?
No. My mother had gay friends, and growing up in Galveston, it was a kind of town that was very accepting of diversity in its way. You know, people, there's all kinds of people in Galveston. And my dad was the state senator for 20 years out of Galveston. And, you know, we got to know everybody. And it just seemed to me, you know, on my side of the family and on my wife's too, there wasn't anybody who certainly said anything out loud about this.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had, we'd have had something to say back.
Talk about your experiences. There were a couple of times before Joseph got to high school when you had called the counselors at school and said, just FYI, you don't have to, you know, tell the kids, but Joseph has come out and we wanted you to be aware of this. What happened then?
Well, at the high school, I sent a note at the middle school, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. This all happened in these few weeks just before the suicide attempt. And so we were left, we informed them and said, this is what's going on. But we really didn't hear much back. And in fact, the suicide attempt and everything else sort of knocked those efforts to let them know out of the way. In elementary school, we had tried to tell various administrators and teachers that we think part of the problem that Joe was having, part of the behavior problem and acceptance problem, was that while nobody was talking about it, we felt increasingly that he was gay and that it was leaving him isolated. And the principal of the elementary school, when we told him that, wrote back a note saying, basically offering condolences and saying, I know how hard it is for you to share this with me.
Hmm.
It's like,
The assumption that somehow you'd be devastated by this news.
Right, that this is shameful or wrong and that this is our problem. We said, no, we're just trying to get you to treat him better.
Mm-hmm.
We're just trying to get you to understand that this might be part of the reason that you're seeing that Joe is such a handful in the classroom, because in elementary school it was hard. And whenever he'd get into conflict with a teacher, and I think one of the teachers especially bore down on him because of a sense that Joe was different, and I think that I knew what the difference was. We were just saying, recognize that this could be a factor, and let's try to be a little more flexible with this kid.
How is he treated today in high school, particularly by the boys in his class that are straight?
Well, it's a great thing. You know, all the stuff we were saying before about greater acceptance and the Gallup poll showing greater acceptance and all the TV and everything, and the fact that New Jersey, where we live, has the strongest anti-bullying laws in the nation, and just a general cultural shift means that Joe, as an out gay kid, is fine. That Joe, who actually has an identity sort of as the gay kid in the same way that Sam was the smart jock, and that these kids, you know, you got the hippies and the stoners and the jocks and all the different flavors of that, and Joe's the gay kid. And at one point in his freshman year of high school, he said, "I really want to dye my hair purple." And Gene and I thought about that a little bit and said, "Well, it's not a tattoo, it's not a piercing." And so we told him that it would be okay, but I warned him. I said, "You know, there's a significant possibility you'll get pounded over this at school. Mm-hmm. Could happen." He said, "I really don't think so. You know, I would have gotten pounded at Ball High for having purple hair, and purple were the school colors, purple and gold. You know, I still would have gotten beat up behind the school." But we took Joe. We got his hair peroxided down since it's dark and got the purple put in, and he showed up at school, and nothing happened.
Hmm.
And in fact, the one time that it looked like something might happen, nothing happened. He was in the locker room, and a kid came up to him, sort of insistent, and said, "I want to know why you dyed your hair purple." And Joe said, "Because it's awesome." And the kid said, "Yeah, but why purple? Why not blue or red?" And Joe said, "Because those colors, that wouldn't work with my coloring."
Mm-hmm.
And the other kid became more insistent, and he said, and Joe swears this is the language he used, he said, "But don't you understand, do you understand that the color purple has been appropriated by the homosexuals?" And another kid looks up and says, "He's really aware of that." And it's a laugh line. And another kid, suddenly, one of the other jocks comes across the room and slams the first kid into the lockers.
Like, what's your problem? Yeah.
Yeah, like, what's the problem? He can dye his hair any color he wants to. He can dye his hair pink if he wants to. And they walk out arguing with each other, which is probably what the second kid wanted in the first place, was to actually, you know, give the other kid a hard time over something.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was incidental to the whole thing. And the moment passes, and Joe's sitting there and looks at the kid that he shares the locker with, and he says, "That was surreal." But he was supported. It was fine. And then Joe found ways to take gym classes that didn't require him to be in the locker room anymore. Because he's not stupid.
Yeah, yeah. It gets better, but it's never perfect, I guess, is the...
Exactly, you know. Exactly. He's got self-preservation instinct.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Andy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to thank the guest for being so accepting and loving to his son. I think I also had a little bit of a rebellious time growing up, and once I finally accepted that I was gay and that it was okay to come out, it was just so rewarding and very, very different, the kind of reaction that you get from people when you no longer, you know, are confrontational about it, or you can just accept yourself the way it is. And I wanted to thank the caller for being so accepting.
Thanks so much for your call. John, you also at times have sought counsel from the parents of other gay teenagers. Talk about the insight they were able to give you as you were just sort of beginning your process with Joseph being out of the closet.
Well, we had friends with, especially one set of friends whose son had come out again in middle school, and he'd had lots of problems and some drug use and other issues. And they were able to talk to us about the sort of psychiatric care that we were seeking at the time and to walk us through, especially after the suicide attempt, what are we looking at here? How long a road are we on? They had been through so much with their son that at one point they had been having serious conversations about what to name the scholarship they were going to name in his honor after he died.
Hmm.
So these other folks gave us the benefit of their experiences, as hard as they were. And there's nothing like the support and connection to other parents. That's why groups like PFLAG at PFLAG.org are so important, because you can meet other parents, other folks who are going through what you're going through, and you can learn from them the message that people have tried so hard to deliver to our kids, the It Gets Better videos that Dan Savage pioneered. Well, there aren't any videos like that for parents, but through groups like PFLAG, you get the message.
Is the PFLAG membership starting to skew younger, so there are parents your age raising kids the age of your kids, as opposed to people who have a 32-year-old that has just come out to them?
Well, it varies a lot from community to community. Of course, each group has its own personality. We found that in one little New Jersey town that we tried, we found that the group was really many older parents, and they didn't have any experience that was quite like ours. They were, in fact, most of them, it seemed, were still dealing with the fallout from their own kids coming out.
Mm-hmm.
20 years before. These were people in their 60s and 70s, and they were lovely people, but they didn't have great advice for us, because we already accepted Joe. We didn't have a problem with it. We wanted to figure out how to best help him.
Right.
But then we got to a PFLAG group in New York City, and it did skew younger, and it was a lot more active, and they were actually saying, oh no, you need to push him out. This is important. And so we found it actually went farther than we wanted to go, but we also felt we were getting valuable information, and by going to talk with them, we learned about the other services at the center, and that's where we started hooking Joe up with this YES program. So I think it's really important to find out for yourself what's going on with these groups. And, of course, there are online connections to PFLAG, too, so that if you don't find the people you're looking for precisely in your community, you can still connect with other parents.
John Schwartz is a national correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thanks so much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.